And what's what I should also add that, you know, what's somewhat confusing in all this is, if you think about it, it's not clear who, for example, the Coalition for the International Criminal Court is representing, because these organizations are all funded by Western money for the most part. So, for example, the Coalition for the International Criminal Court, which is this huge organization, and it has a Congolese chapter with which we worked. I mean, I worked in the DRC. I mean, their positions, I don't really know who they're representing at times. Are they representing really the interests of Congolese victims or of Western or Western power interests in a way? So, I mean, there's definitely this is a multifaceted discussion in a way. Who is the International Criminal Court representing? Are these Western interests? I mean, why are some Africans supportive of the court, and others against it? Yeah, this is something that is hard to really address in such a short presentation. But I think that it's definitely multifaceted, and it's definitely an important discussion to have, though there is, I don't think there is any easy answer, and I don't really see any easy way forward to the court right now, because I think what's going on, this is not what people expected. This is certainly not what people expected, and I've been reading, for example, commentary from, say, 2009, 2010, and a recurrent theme in all these, in the literature, is essentially that people are dismissive of these complaints. They thought that this would just go away, and people just think that this will go away even now. And I mean, it's been 4 years now that the African Union has repeatedly just denounced the court, and I don't think it's going away, and I think that something will have to be done about it. The international community, the court, the Security Council will have to address it.
And the African Union is taking its own action, right? I mean, the arrest of Nkunda in 2009 in Eastern Congo is, you know, it seems like something the International Criminal Court would have otherwise been involved with. Anyway,
that's a separate issue.
I guess I'll try to touch on your three main points really quickly. I guess the one about the U.S. government being reluctant to listen to students, yes, definitely. But there are different, you know, the government, just like a human rights, you know, network or any type of entity is not monolithic. So there are different elements within the U.S. government who actually do listen to and sometimes actively solicit the advice of these types of students. So in the early 1960s, you know, there are actually students. So the president of the Iranian Student Association, Ali Fatemi, who is kind of the main protagonist in the early 60s when the student movement is pretty focused, he actually is meeting with people like Robert Kennedy, Supreme Court Justice William Douglas, even Robert Comer at one point. Like, so there are different people who solicit the advice of these students. You know, in the 70s, it becomes, you know, kind of these new internationalist congressional representatives, sometimes because, you know, you have congressional representatives who want to, you know, this is, you know, check the power of the executive branch after Watergate, or, you know, to avoid future Vietnams, or, you know, that the idea that human rights, you know, can actually further U.S. interests. There are people who think that, but then there are others who actually kind of do identify, you know, Dellums and Chisholm and Perrin Mitchell and all these types of people, members of the Congressional Black Caucus, who actually do, you know, I think take the concerns and the criticisms of the relationship between the United States and Iran a bit more seriously than others who just kind of see human rights as a way to further U.S. interests. So there are different factions in the U.S. government who do solicit the advice of, you know, these non, that essentially, you know, many of the West German student movement leaders credit as igniting the West German student movement. So there's a student who is shot in West Berlin, and this kind of radicalizes the movement. You know, Ulrike Meinhof writes a letter, open letter to Farah Diba, who was the Shah's wife, and it's circulated throughout students in West Germany. So, you know, the Iranians were kind of situated in the middle of that kind of student internationalism in the late 1960s. That, you know, the human rights element isn't there per se. It's a critique of kind of the excessive use, the abuse of state power but it's not necessarily through the language of human rights all the time. It kind of starts to pop up. And as far as the protagonist, again, some of these answers don't actually have to do with human rights, so I don't want to go into them in much detail, but you know, the protagonist by the 70s, it's kind of a more disparate group of actors. Whereas in the early 1960s, you can actually pinpoint, you know, the primary leaders of the student movement, the primary Americans who are kind of soliciting their advice. Whereas in the 1970s, it's a bit more kind of, it's just, you know, more disparate. You know, and some of them are actually end up being prominent, you know, so Sadegh Kosbadeh, who becomes the foreign minister in Iran and is eventually executed in 1982 for, you know, betraying the revolution, was one of the primary student leaders in the U.S. in the 1960s, who is kind of meeting with U.S. officials. And he becomes, you know, he goes one route. He becomes a professional revolutionary. The other, Fatemi, who I mentioned earlier, becomes an economics professor at Akron. So there are kind of protagonists early on, but by this, like in the chapter in the piece you read, it's definitely kind of this larger, you know, network rather than specific individuals per se, I think.
I'll ask a quick question because Patrick answered the first question I was going to ask, which was about the sort of split between sort of the state and civil society organizations who are trying to toggle between strengthening the rule of law domestically against the state and yet acknowledging the sometimes conflicting impact of the ICC's indictments on their ability to mobilize popular support for the rule of law domestically. For Matthew, I mean, I think this is very interesting, and I think that one of the interesting things is that in Iran, as opposed to, say, South Korea, which is still experiencing rapid economic growth in the mid-70s, you know, economic growth is slowing, inflation is rising, the Shah is pouring all the money he's getting from the oil price shocks into buying weapons. And so a lot of these students, from my understanding, are experiencing declining economic opportunities. There's a sort of the same sort of crisis of employment that other students are facing in other countries, which in some ways is even more grotesque in Iran because it's a fabulously wealthy country and the most educated, you know, elites are going abroad, getting educated, and coming back, and there's nothing for them to do.
We're not going back.
We're not going back. And so there's a sort of economic dimension to this, which is a sort of crisis of the white revolution, which has given the lie to modernization leading to democracy, which is important here.